Greetings, friends. Here we are, podcast number 2 for the week. I'm about to head to the beach with my family, so I don't have time to do a long, beautiful intro with incredibly complex music that sometimes takes me months to compose in my special studio here in the mountains. Rather, we're just going to jump right in to this episode. Ian Fidance is a brilliant comedian who I've been lucky enough to be friends with ever since my stint in New York City. He was one of the first comics that I made friends with, and it has been incredible to watch this brilliant comedian's incredible journey through the world of stand-up comedy. He is so funny. If you ever are lucky enough to have him perform in your area, you got to go see him. He goes on the road with me sometimes, and he is a true crusher when it comes to comedy. But not only that, he is a really deep, sweet, brilliant, mystical dude who I am really, really fortunate to be friends with. So won't you please shower him with all kinds of love? He's IanAnimal69 on Instagram, Twitch, and Twitter. He's got a really funny podcast called Bye Guys. That's B-I Guys on Gas Digital. And he's going to be at the Moon Tower Comedy Festival September 23rd to the 25th. Go to his website, IanFidance.com. He's got dates coming up on his own and with the great Dave Attell. And now, welcome back to the DTFH, Ian Fidance. Yeah, man, you found an incredible hat. You know, that's just that will make my year.
Bro, I am so excited about this hat. I set out 2 weeks ago to get a bucket hat, and I went to a store called World of Hats on the Lower East Side, and I FaceTimed my girlfriend to pick one out, and I'm like in the store, and the guy's like, I would FaceTime her and go, what do you think? And then I looked at him. I go, do I have your approval? And he was like, yes. And once they agreed, I was like, that's it. That's the one.
Wow.
And I've been getting compliments. It feels so nice. Yeah. You affirmed it. Thank you.
It's a hat of glory. You find them maybe once a year. You know, it's a wild thing, the different paths people's lives take. But it's just interesting to think at some point, somebody was like, you know what? I'm going to create World of Hats. And
yes.
It's just going to be a fuck ton of hats.
Well,
and you know what I'm saying? It's like we have weird jobs, but isn't it weirder to run a hat store than be a comedian?
Well, I will say yes. And I will add to that. It's very weird to run a hat store called World of Hats that only sells hats that makes it through a global pandemic in New York City. That this place is getting so many customers. It's not only stayed in business, but it's thriving to the point where I tried to talk him down off me paying the full price for the hat. And he goes, I can't do it. We have, I talked him down $15. I tried to go 25. And I said to him, I go, you sure you don't want to go hit my price? It looks like I'm the only one in the store, you know, trying to be like,
yeah,
this is the best you're going to get. And he goes, yesterday someone bought $3,000 worth of hats. And I was like, well, fair enough.
You tried to hat haggle someone who started a place called World of Hats. And you were fucking thwarted because, well, what are you thinking? A New York hat store? You think that guy can't read your bluff? He knew you wanted that hat, and he knew it was a hat of glory.
Well, I mean, I tried to haggle a hat in the World of Hats, and I was in for a world of hurt because it didn't get down to the price I wanted.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness that's preventing you from achieving your goals? Like, I don't know, maybe you have like some creeping sense that your penis is shrinking? BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. It's not like I'm obsessing over that, by the way, the penis shrinking thing. It's just like every once in a while, I look at it and I think, this is part of getting old. I mean, maybe I'm not quite as comfortable with getting old as I thought I was, because it's not just like, shit, is my penis shrinking, but the gray hair is now really coming in, and I'm thinking, should I dye my hair? But isn't that kind of weird? Like, shouldn't I just surrender to death? But that sounds so severe. Is it normal to kind of like dig through pictures of my dad's hunting trips and like kind of start tearing up? You can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp, that's H-E-L-P, wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website. They've got a billion testimonials. People love them. Just go to betterhelp.com/reviews and check it out. And then go to betterhelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com/Duncan. And join the over 2 million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. Again, the DTFH listeners get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Duncan. Yeah, man, you can't haggle a hat man. Not in New York. I mean, maybe like some like subsidiary, like County of Hats, House of Hats, or something. You're not gonna
House of Hats hat apartment. I got him down. I got him down 15, but I was trying to go 25.
Like, if you're not that confident, you start hat apartment. If you've got a lot of confidence, it's World of Hats. What a pain in the ass, though, man. Like, just to run a hat store. And what is he always looking at hats?
I mean,
does he spend his time when he's at work ordering, finding like lines on cheap hats? And
I mean,
like a hell.
I wish you could have seen this store. And and across the street was a store called Italian Clothing. I'm like, if there was ever a nexus of the universe where I belong, it's at World of Hats and Italian Clothing.
Yeah, that's like kind of like when you realize like, oh, I died. This is just heaven. I'm in between. Well, congrats on the great hat. Congrats on the new love. I see that you found a new love.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awesome. I've noticed your Instagram is filling up with images of this beautiful woman. Can you tell us a little bit about how that transpired?
Well, goodness gracious, great balls of fi dance. I am in love. It's very nice. She's so smart and fun and funny and obviously gorgeous. But I swear to God, we are 100% balls to the wall sober, falling down, tears in our eyes, laughing just at random parts of the day. And I really feel like I've You know, we really complement each other well. I ended up, she used to be a waitress at a comedy club years ago, and we kind of vaguely remember, like, you know, passing chips, you know, yeah. But she was at a show.
What do you mean? Wait, what do you mean passing chips?
Like, just to, like, we may have run into each other.
Oh, passing chips. Like, I thought you said passing chips, like potato chips.
Yeah.
Passing chips. Gotcha.
I met her years ago. I was giving her salt and vinegar chips, you know, like a drug meal.
What kind of weird club is this?
Yeah.
Okay, passing chips in the night.
Yeah, she used to wait tables at Stress Factory in Jersey, and then I ended up... she was at a show at the Stand, and when I saw her, I was like, this is the most beautiful creature I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And from the stage, I, like, hit on her. I, like, commented how, like, I was going to marry her or something like that, you know? Like, I had a spot after that, so I gave the manager my Instagram on a sheet of paper, and I go, give it to that girl. I got to run. And he did, and she followed me and DM'd me. And
wow.
we were talking for a while, and then we started hanging out. And ever since we started hanging out, we've seen each other almost every single day. She,
wow, you congrats.
Know, I did a week in Vegas. She came down for half the week. I was in Philly with Attell. She came down for a night. She's just the everyone that meets her is just like, dude, she's the truth, man. She's the coolest. I'm so lucky and fortunate, you know, especially because you and I spoke about, you know, where I was like a year ago with, you know, living in hell with a terrible relationship. So
you were in the kind of relationship where like sometimes you don't, it sounded like you might not get out of it. Like you were in one of those like pre Dateline relationships, you know.
I was you know, one step away from being an episode of Forensic Files.
Yeah, that it's, I mean, it's my wife and I, man, we fucking watch some dark shit, and we love watching Dateline. We love watching, like, we just love it. I don't know why it's so fucked up. I think we both acknowledge that it's fucked up.
Yeah,
but there's just something just so astounding about seeing like a relationship that has turned into the, like these people, they ostensibly, they met, they're in love. They think about each other. They were thinking about each other when they're apart and missing and longing after each other. And then one of them's like, you want to go on a hike, and just shoving them down off a cliff into the sea to get insurance.
She always was trying to get me to hike, and I'm so glad the weather got in the way.
Oh, don't fucking hike. If you are in a shitty relationship, do not go on a hike. That's what I've learned from Dateline, because they will, it's just, you know what I mean? That's, to me, kind of the astounding quality of human intimate relationships is like how, you know, friendships, they can go sour where you're just annoyed with one of your friends or whatever, but usually you just don't talk to them for a while, and then you like make up, and then you're friends again. But it's crazy how with like intimate relationships, nuts.
it's so funny. I was just speaking to a dear friend today about how, like, you know, my life today is just filled with so much gratitude. And we all went through different levels of hell this past year. But for me personally, going through this relationship, which I knew at the time, and I even said to you, like, it's not love. I had mistaken chemistry for love.
Yes.
And there was very much the cycle of abuse that she was putting me through ticked off this relation to childhood trauma that I went through with the abuse and kind of things that I faced as a child that almost made me feel comfortable in a way. And I really empathize with people that are in relationships and they can't get out. And everyone goes, why don't you just leave? It's so much deeper. And when you're trauma bonded and when this abuse cycle feels this childhood familiarity. And it's so funny because, you know, I really understand how people can give false confessions, because she would talk in circular ways and gaslight and really, you know, and I have to say, she's an incredibly sick person with borderline personality disorder. And I feel so hard for her. And
yeah,
I pray every it, dude, this got me closer to God. I was doing so many different things to get better. And I pray for her and her wellness, you know, because she is, you know, incredibly sick, and I wish nothing but her health for her. But when a lot of people with borderline personality disorder, they don't see it because it's always everyone else's fault. And, you know, getting into therapy is such a hard thing for them. And I really applaud and respect anyone that has this personality disorder and does get therapy. But, you know, just the way I would get talked to and circular talked and gaslit, and I would just agree to things to stop the conversation, you know, to stop getting yelled at. And I would put my head down, and it reminded me of being that little kid that, you know, my mom was traumatized from my dad's death and she didn't know how to deal with it. So her brain was broken and she would just blow up at me for no reason. I just remember as a kid putting my head down and going, yes, yes, okay. And it would be the same thing. And I felt this weird, it was like a bridge to my childhood in a negative way. So I had a hard time getting out of that. And every time I did try to get out of the relationship, I was met with, you know, threats of suicide, self-harm. And so then I stayed in it because I was so afraid of what would happen to her. And I'll say, you know, in relation to that abusive pattern that became so familiar to me because it was like a bridge to my childhood in a negative way with this relationship.
Yes.
You know, in my current relationship, there's a bridge to my childhood of absolute joy that she says to me, I love your smile and I love when you laugh because I can see little Ian. I can see the kid you were that had so much happiness inside of you.
Wow.
And that means so much to me because, you know, and again, gratitude, this relationship that I went through that was complete hell and turmoil, it got me into therapy twice a week. I started, you know, CBT therapy, which really helped. You know, I was reading all these books. I was doing these worksheets. I was like journaling. I was praying. I was, you know, I gave up dating women, porn, masturbation. I gave up everything and just sat in the uncomfortability and sludge of what it was. And I was just sobbing and crying for days. And because of that, I was really trying to access and talk to that inner child of mine. And it's so wildly serendipitous, I guess, that without even knowing that, the person I'm with now, with whom I feel such a kinship and love, apropos of nothing, goes, I love your laugh and your smile. I see that child that you were. And I'm like, that's what I've been trying to access. That's what I've been working towards, you know, which was such a wink and a nod from the universe. And it's like, you're good, buddy. Things are good, you know?
Yeah, it's that aspect of 12-step programs is the part that really mirrors like all the magical systems I've heard about, or the manifestation systems people talk about. They have is this like fundamental like element, gratitude. It's always like, if you want to start manifesting, if you want to get your shit back on track, the first step is always gratitude. Yeah. And, you know, if you're in a shitty time in your life and you hear that, you're like, all right, well, and then you start faking gratitude maybe, or you know what I mean? Like saying like, I'm so happy that I came off.
Dude,
but really, you're just like, fuck this.
I could not find anything I was grateful for. I just felt so bitter and hurt and upset, no gratitude. So I had to start writing things down. And it, dude, right. It got to the simplest thing of like, I'm grateful I have limbs that work. I'm grateful that my legs yes. can take me somewhere, you know, and I had to start and like lay down a foundation of gratitude and like build from there. And dude, I gotta say, yeah. like, I'm just finding so much gratitude in everything. And also, you know, this past year has been a medication journey for me, where before the pandemic, I was like, let me try. Dude, before the pandemic, I was like, I'm having a hard time coming, so let me change my depression meds. And that started
yeah, right.
a chain of events of like, while I'm going through this and a global pandemic, I'm off and on different meds trying to figure out. And, you know, I do have a biological chemical thing inside of my brain that needs to be addressed. And I finally found the proper medication that works. It's really helped out. And it's,
what is
it's, I'm on Zoloft, Lamotrigine, and Effexor. And it's like the depression is a fog that I can't get out of. And this just kind of squeegees it. And, I can see, and I'm like living the life that I wasn't motivated to live enough while I was in it, you know? And, like this time last year, I ended up in the hospital going fucking nuts. And here I am catching up with you and living my best life.
Yeah. You know, man, medication, finding that. But I was taking Adderall and then I tried taking another ADD medication because of fucking ADD. I like lose everything yeah. constantly and I have to have a fucking fanny
Dude,
pack.
I wear a fanny pack.
It's the answer. If you have ADHD, it will fix. You will get an extra 30 minutes at least yes. per day because you're not looking for your shit. You just have to find the big, stupid fanny pack. But yeah, man, I can't. It's like I just had to go off them completely because it was like making me into an asshole, man. I was like crashing, getting yeah. shitty, and like just I feel much better now, but. It's such an interesting, like, part of modern life is, like, you know, number one, acknowledging that you, like, having the humility to admit that you need help. Yeah. You know, because a lot of people just don't want to admit that. They're, like, going to totally. Commit to being out of, like, out of balance neurologically.
Well, I mean, I've been on medication my entire life since I was, like, 8. And it's so funny because God bless my mom, but, you know, medication only works if you're on it for a period of time, it gets into your blood, and then after 6 weeks you go, yeah. oh, this is making me a monster. Well, time to change it up. You know, so it takes right. a while to, like, be in your system, but God bless my mom. I mean, it really set me off on a bad track, but she would give me my meds, and then I'd be like, I don't feel good or I don't like it. She go, ah, you don't have to take it today. And then like, so
oh,
I was just like a rubber band being stretched back and forth. And then I yeah. have this thing inside me that the second, you know, if I'm working out and you're like, hey, your bod looks hot. I go, I got what I wanted. Don't need to work out anymore. So the second I feel good, I go, I don't got to take my meds anymore. I'm good. You know?
Yeah. Right. That's mm-hmm. the problem, isn't it? That's the fucking problem. It's not just the feeling bad thing. It's that you, once you get, because once you get balanced, you aren't going to, you're not, it's like, that is the problem with gratitude. It's like the stuff that's working, you're probably not thinking about it because it's yeah. working. It's like when your car is running smoothly, you're not thinking about your brakes, right. or your brake pads, or, you know, and so it's so, it becomes so perfect, it's yeah. invisible. And so people, when they're, at least me, when I'm like going down the path of gratitude or trying to find, like trying to do the gratitude exercises that everyone I know who is like spectacularly successful recommends, I that's what I have to pull those threads of like, okay, I can mm-hmm. shit. I can yeah. piss. My knees yeah. are working. Like right now I'm trying to lose weight. So it's like, instead of beating myself up because of the weight that I'm at, I think, you know what? Just pretend you were 190 pounds yeah. yesterday and you just lost 10 pounds, you would be fucking over the moon. You know what I mean? Like, so far, like, I use tricks to induce the gratitude. But have you noticed that when you do start eliciting, like when you do start kind of unnaturally or doing like the forced gratitude exercises, that all of a sudden your heart just starts opening naturally? Yes. It's like it reactivates something, and then and then you do start getting those natural gratitude bursts that weren't there before. Yeah,
and it's also a thing of, like, you know, acting your way into better thinking, you know, and at the same time, it's really, really hard to admit this, and I see this in other people, and I hate it in them because I see it in myself, but there's a very real part of me, and I think this occurs in a lot of people, where I get a sick pleasure out of wallowing in the messy bog. When everything is bad, it's like this sick, like, oh, poor me. And that's hard to get out of. So you have to kind of, and the answer is gratitude. You know, the answer is, you know, I was writing out affirmations, and I still am, you know, where stuff like, I deserve love. I deserve happiness. I am worthy of loving myself. I am, you know, like, again, like, I'm grateful that I can, you know, that I have a bicycle that I get to ride. I'm grateful that my legs work, that I have feeling in my hands, you know, and once you start to get that, I mean, it truly feels like you're, you know, when people get a head injury and they take them to the fake grocery store and they go, okay, so you need to get 3 apples. And if the apples cost $2, how much do you pay at checkout? You know, and you're like, $4. Like, I feel that way when I'm retraining my brain to, like, act and think better. But you're right. When you open up that little bit of gratitude, you just have your foot in the door a little bit. And then it just gets blown off the hinges and you enter this room of just beauty and thankfulness that I can't help but just spread to other people. And that's what I've always, that's who I was when I was younger. I was, you know, such an energetic, happy, loving person. And I lost that for a while. And I really feel like I have it back, and it's just emanating from me wherever I go. And I'm grateful for that. And I know it won't always be there, but I'm grateful it's there right now. Sure.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Because I think the other trick is, then once you do start getting in that, like, flow where you are, like, spontaneously experiencing bouts of gratitude versus spontaneously experiencing bouts of, like, self-pity or wallowing in the muck or just being some, you know, Jacob's Ladder style fucking, like, demon rolling around in your own mental filth and pretending there's something, like, courageous or even or interesting, you know, because that's like the when it really becomes the when you if you really want to break through the floor and really go down into the hell basement, what you do is you stop resisting the collapsed in state, and then you start deluding yourself into thinking there's something, like, special or something about it. You know what I mean? Like, so now it's not just that you're it's like, you know what I mean, it's like one thing to have a horrible bout of diarrhea and to be like, oh my God, this is horrible. I have diarrhea. This sucks. It's another thing to be like, yeah, but, like, I've got the most incredible fucking diarrhea.
Yeah.
Like, my diarrhea. I'm not the kind of guy who changes his pants after he shits himself. Yeah. I leave it on because I'm real. That's how you really, like, head down the tube into the base sub-basements
of hell.
It's like
that William S. Burroughs hero worship of heroin, you know, of, like, thinking like, I'm not like other addicts, I'm artistic about it. It's like, no, dude, you're a fucking heroin addict. You're shooting dope into your veins. Like, let's not church it up, you know.
This is the disaster of disasters. Is what happens is you get these, like, profoundly brilliant poets and artists who then get on heroin, and then they just do they administer a kind of massive cruelty to the world, which is they write and their genius comes through their addiction, but then in their description of their addiction, people who aren't poets and artists start getting this feeling of, like, wow, maybe if I start fucking mainlining like Burroughs, that'll push my career to the next level. And then they're fucking just nodding out in fucking an alley in Philadelphia.
I mean, yeah, the delusion of grandeur with addiction and everything. Like, when I was drinking, I thought I was Rust Cole from True Detective. You know, I thought I was like this deep, like, you know, every time I talked, I thought, you know, my soundtrack was a Marshall Tucker Band song. Just, you know, like, but in reality, I'm waking up in piles of garbage on the street, like literally waking up in a gutter, like surrounded by glass because I couldn't open the beer bottle. I had to smash it. And it's like, buddy, what are you doing? You know?
Oh, God damn, Ian. That's fucked up, man. I mean, but it, you know, that is, I do like that thing you're talking about. When I was addicted to ketamine, that was, I was like making music and I'm like, this has got to be the best fucking music anyone's ever made. And then you go back and listen.
You play it back and it sounds like a robot short circuiting. You're like, what am I doing?
Yeah. You know, it's like, chemical narcissism is just embarrassing. Right. And you know, as comics and artists, we understand the rough draft. You know what I mean? We understand that the final thing that people are saying or seeing, it's a magic trick. If you're good enough to get up on stage and make it seem like, you know, it's just what coming free flowing out of me naturally. I didn't spend a year, 2 years developing this fucking joke, eating fucking shit, trying to get this joke to work. No, I just off the cuff. It's, you know, it's here. These fucking addict poets, they do the same goddamn thing, which is, it's like probably the initial scrawl that they write, you know, or covered in their puke or like the blood dripping out their nose from doing blow is garbage. And then somehow they have the fucking discipline in the midst of their addiction to refine and refine and refine till you get this beautiful final product. And that is, any idiot reads that and is like, wow, I could do that. I mean, we have something in common. We both love booze. So, I mean, I'm halfway to being Charles Bukowski, right? I'm almost there. But it's just not the case. You don't need to get fucked up to make good art.
I mean, it's just funny, man. I was home visiting my mom and I found like an old journal I wrote in when I was living in a farmhouse in Delaware, drinking my face off. You know, I was a carpenter and everything. And I found in this journal that I'd write in when I was drunk, I want to be a comedian in New York City. I want to be paid for writing. I want to be living off. Wow. I wish I could do stand up. You can if you just get sober. I can't stop drinking, blah, blah. And I'm reading this and I'm like, oh my God, buddy, you're doing it. Like, this was your dream actualized. Wow. And, you know, what a way to be, you know, it's like my past self is meeting with my present self. And in a way, it's like, I'm giving myself like a cosmic high five of like, dude, you're fucking doing it. You got sober, you know, your dream is actualized. And I have so many more things to do, but it's just a reminder. None of those things will be done if I'm not sober.
It's like you found a message in a bottle to yourself that you threw out into the time ocean and it just washed up onto your shore now.
Totally.
Like, wow.
And I mean, we've talked about this before, but, you know, my dad wrote me letters before he left for work every morning. And I found those. And in seeing them in hindsight, and I never realized this.
Oh, it's so sweet.
Yeah, I'm so fortunate for that. You know, I never realized this until I reread them about maybe a year ago, but so many of his letters were like, just be yourself. You're such a wonderful person. We love when you're just Ian. Don't try to be anyone else but yourself. We love you no matter what. Wow. And it's like, I never knew that, never actualized it until I saw these like a year ago. I was like, wow, what a gift. What, again, like a message in a bottle that I have received that's been floating in the ocean of my past for so many years, you know?
How many letters did you write?
Oh, my God, Duncan, I have stacks. I mean, I want to compile a book where I, you know, just transcribe them and because they're so beautiful and they're just, you know, they're like a recap from the day before, just a reminder that I'm loved and, you know, things to look forward. And he was such a, like, goofball. You know, there's like silly jokes on there, and it's just really beautiful that I have this, you know.
Oh my God, you're so lucky. I like, you know, we're part of the generation that doesn't have our entire childhoods like digitized for us by our parents. Like my kids are gonna like, there's not gonna be a single day where there isn't some picture of like one of them covered in food and whatever, you know. And it's like I was going through pictures the other day. Like I have very few, and except what's in my mind, and that's like supremely foggy. Mm. You know, I'm like right now I'm working on a little writing project, and so as part of that, I took a trip because I'm up here where I grew up. So I took a trip to like the city I grew up in, and was like, "Do you ever do that?"
Yeah, I mean, when I go back to Delaware, I always drive around my old haunts. I always drive back to the house I was born in, which was a couple blocks away from that farmhouse I was drinking myself to death in.
Who's in that house now?
I don't know. I stopped by years ago and you know, met the people that live there, but it's been turned over so many times. But yeah, I totally relate to that. So you went back to the city you grew up in?
Well, yeah, and just tried to like make a little like, you know, there's just having a kid now and like, you know, seeing the world through his eyes, and then like, it's like teaching me a lot about, you know, like time and the way things and change. And I don't know, it's just like, I went by this old house that like, it's old now, but when I was there, it's all dilapidated and shit. It's like, you know, when you're a kid, your driveway or what that little space that you would play in or whatever the thing was, it's
huge.
Big. It's like, it's huge. Yeah. And it seems so like, I don't know, mystical or like, you know, but now I drove up there, this fucking house, man, is spooky now. Like it's completely dilapidated. The driveway is like overgrown, like grass is just growing out of it. It's the whole place is fucking crumbling. And I was like, oh, cool. It's abandoned now. Like maybe I could like sneak in through a window or something like that and really go nuts and just, but so I pull my car up and some fucking big dogs in the window like, you can never go back. You can't return. But like, you know, to me, that's kind of the, when you're talking about your relationship and this desire to connect with yourself as a child, and you know what I mean, there's something so poignant in the impossibility of that endeavor in certain ways. In other ways, you definitely can, you still are that kid. It doesn't go anywhere, but I mean, the physical, the stage that you grew up on and all the people who are on that stage, for me, they're all dead. Most of them are dead. They're all gone. So it's like, there's just something very incredibly poignant and intense about that quality, the continuum of self. I mean, and also not just the people that you knew are gone, you knew are gone, the drunk Ian in the fucking farmhouse. Who's that? Where? What happened to that person? Like, gone. Like, that person is for all intents and purposes, right? Gone, right? That might as well have been a past incarnation.
Totally. I mean, I could access him again. I could go back to that, but why would I ever want to go back to that? You know, I look at pictures of who I was and I'm like, who is that guy? Like, I can't believe that guy like existed. And I'm grateful he existed. I learned a lot from him, you know. Years ago, I used to work at a sober living house, and me and two of my buddies, the therapist there, she was like our therapist and everything. And we did a group session where we were supposed to talk to our inner child. And, dude, I froze up and stormed out of the session. For years, I could not access that kid that was so hurt and, you know, just completely shattered and traumatized from everything. I couldn't talk to him. I couldn't look at him. And to be able to access him and go back and like comfort him and have him realized and let him be a part of me now is like such a gift, you know, because I did have so much joy as a kid, and then it, you know, all went away. So anytime I experience like just pure unfiltered joy, a part of me is like, hell yeah, little dude, that's for you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, man. If you ever, do you ever think you'll have kids?
You know, it's funny. I really didn't want kids for a long time, and this past year put a lot in perspective. And you know, in August of last year, it was a very real possibility, and that ended up not happening. And
yeah, I read your posts about that, man. That's a lot of took a lot of guts to post about going through that. I'm sorry. I don't know if it's okay to mention that on the podcast. Yeah.
I mean, I also think with everything that's happening in Texas, like it is 100% a woman's issue, but I think it's important for men to also speak up because it does affect them in a way, you know? Like I very much had this weird come to Jesus moment where like it was kind of up in the air whether or not we were going to have an abortion, and I came to a level of acceptance where I was like, "Okay, I'll be a dad." Like I can, like I felt this like calm, and then, you know, she said, we're not going to have it. And I said, okay. And, you know, it kind of, something shifted in me, you know, and, I do think I, you know, I see you as a father and I'm like, that is the coolest thing in the world. And especially, you know, like looking at your age and everything you've accomplished and gone through, you know, like you didn't have kids young, you've had children older, and you have so much more to give them in your years that you've been on earth rather than you would have if you were younger. And you know, I would like to have kids and a family when I'm fully prepared, and I would like to do that within the decade. No timeline. Maybe it won't happen, maybe it will. You know, we've already talked about it, and she definitely doesn't want to have kids until, you know, she's kind of into her 30s a bit. And that for me is a sigh of relief, because you know, again, in my past relationship it was, I want this by this time, this, the clock is ticking, and I'm like, oh god, too much, you know. And
that sucks, the ticking clock. People, that sucks
totally.
This, that kind of pressure is so fucked up. You should never have a kid unless you like really want to have a kid. Like that's when you have a kid. This thing of like, you know, bringing a kid into the world when you that's not what you want to do.
And when you put a timeline on it, you are starting to paint yourself into a corner where if I don't have everything done by then, you know, the last thing I want to do is to not be able to dedicate myself entirely to my family. And I know right now I can't do that, you know, and I know that I have a lot more things I want to accomplish. And at the same time, I want to be able to take care of my family monetarily. And right now I can, I'm fortunate. I'm in a position where I can very well take care of myself, but I don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars that I'll have to put towards my child and their education and everything like that.
Yeah. No, you need, it's fucking expensive, man. Having kids is fucking expensive. And I don't care. You have to cross this abyss. It's truly, and like sometimes in magical circles, they talk about this thing, crossing the abyss. And there's a lot of different definitions, but one of the abysses you have to cross is the abyss of just selfishness. And you might not want to admit, your people might not want to admit they're fucking selfish. But when you have a kid, it's like you see it. Like the selfishness becomes like as clear as like is like mud on a spotlight, and that you just see it. It's like vivid, and you just, I don't know if I'll ever get rid of my fucking selfishness, but the crossing the abyss part is like, you have to start letting go of all the self-centeredness that you can. Like, you have to just really figure out a way to jettison that shit, or you're going to be waking up at night gritting your teeth, feeling regret, and you know, thinking like, God, you know, if I didn't have fucking kids, I could be sitting on the couch blowing rails of ketamine playing God of War.
Well, and it's this weird Tinder. Like,
which is not the best.
It's this weird collision of worlds of like letting go and acceptance at the same time, and the balance between the two, you know. And I don't, you know, last night we ordered soup dumplings and watched Capturing the Freedmans. And it's like, I don't know if I could do that if I had a kid, you know?
No, you can't. That's the thing. Like, you can't, like, you're like, we've gone out to eat this week. We went out to eat twice. The first time we went out to eat ended up in the emergency room because Forrest has allergies. And I ended up like making, I got an ice cream maker, made a big vat of ice cream, but didn't cook the eggs enough. He's allergic to egg whites. And so like right before we leave to eat, I'm like, have some ice cream. He eats the ice cream. He's fine. It's no, but when you have a kid with allergies, it's like, it's not, the emergency room becomes a little less intense. They're used to it, but you basically like, you have to, we've only had to do it twice in 2 years, but you have to EpiPen the kid. And then no matter what, if you do that, you have to take him to the hospital for observation just to be super. Oh, yeah, he's fine. He's totally fine. Sure. Thank you for asking. But I'm just saying that's that night. And then the second night, the babysitter was just texting because the youngest one just she came after he'd fallen asleep. And so he's crying for milk and she goes in and picks him up. And he's like, who the fuck are you? And it's just like screaming. So then we thought, oh, God, we're going to have to go home twice in a row here, which is no big deal. But I'm just saying, like, the type of flex that you learn, a kind of flexibility where it's like you have to just be in the moment, moving with things as they're happening. I think it's a great thing to learn, and I'm really glad that I have learned it. But, yeah, the whole dumpling fantasy and all that stuff, it's going to go on hiatus for a long time.
I was just in Vegas for a week. And when I came back, my cat was like wildly vocal when he saw me. And after a certain point, I'm like, okay, is he excited to see me or does he have a UTI that I don't know about? What's going on? I could not imagine that happening with a child. Like, I could not imagine, you know. My cat's, like, whining, man. And I'm like, oh God, did he hurt his paw? I couldn't imagine a baby crying and trying to decipher what is going on.
Right. Yeah, right. And like, it's truly, you know, someone like me who has, like, some of the most profoundly selfish tendencies on earth, it's a wonderful gift because it like it's a truly like rehabilitation for selfishness. Right. But yeah, don't I guess the essence of the thing is, you're totally right. When you have a kid, when you're like ready to like step into a forge of the universe and get your fucking hair blazed off by like the primordial thrust of sentience into this dimension. Otherwise, just fucking guilt-free dumplings, movies, fucking
nonstop.
We're
going to the beach this weekend. You know, it's like...
I'm going to the beach this weekend. We're pulling this off because my mother-in-law's in town. She's going to be with the kids. But let me tell you, we might be coming back. You know what I mean? You're going to go to the beach and you don't know... Nothing. You're not going to get a call. It's like your fucking cat. UTI has come back again. Yeah. You know what I mean? But yes, that's the difference in our beach trips. At some point, I'm going to be consoling Erin, who will probably be crying because she's missing being with the kids because she's that's what happens.
I mean, that's what Olivia's going to do to me about my cat, you know, because he is my son. So.
Is she gonna rub your back, Ian?
I'm Zalvin Samson. You know, I was supposed years ago, I was supposed to get a vasectomy. I was like so dead set, no kids. And I have chronic epididymitis. Yeah. And so my It's What's that? The epididymis swells and becomes inflamed. That's like the tube that connects your testicle to your urethra for the sperm to travel through.
Okay.
So mine gets inflamed. And actually recently, it was like a last ditch effort with my urologist. He was like, look, I'm going to give you these, you have to take these pain shots in your spine. And if that doesn't eliminate the pain, you have to get your epididymis removed, which means you can't have kids. So I get these shots in my spine every 6 months to a year, and it fixed the pain, which is great. But I was I had my two consultations for the vasectomy, and we had scheduled when it was going to be. And then my epididymitis cropped up, and they were like, oh, we have to push it back. And I was like, maybe that's a sign from God. I'm not going to do it, you know? And thank God.
I think after our second kid, we were kind of talking about, you know, maybe we'll just like, maybe, but I didn't know. So I think we were talking about if we have another one, we'll do that. But I don't want to do that ever. Like, I don't want to do that. I think there is something really, I mean, it is insane that humans are able to even reproduce. That it's the most, to me, it's the most ridiculous thing. Fucking to make a baby.
Well, the process is ridiculous. You know, you're just heaving yourself on someone just.
Yeah. But it sounds like, you know, when you think about God, or if you want to believe in God or want to play around with, like, well, we can kind of understand God from the way the universe works. God is like a baby. Like, it's like baby logic. You know what I mean? You push.
Yeah.
You
mash
push
together.
You mash, and then she will grow in her stomach. Another one
in
will
her
come.
Belly, she make your baby.
Yeah.
Oh, do you open the belly? No, you push out your pee-pee. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, right, God. I guess we'll do it. Whatever you say. But you know what I mean? There's nothing. It's the most bizarre thing when I'm like. In Forrest, we've like, he kind of understands it, not the fucking part, but like, he knows he was in my wife's stomach somehow. And every once in a while, he'll be like, the other day, he goes, gonna go back in your vagina. Gonna go back in your vagina. That'd be cute.
Oh my God. He's putting on goggles. What are you doing? Getting ready to go back in the vagina?
You ain't going back, kid. There's no way. I mean, that's the other crazy thing about this flow of time that we're in, right, man? It's just like there's no way other than like great therapy, hypnosis to really go back, man. We're like atrophying. You know what I mean? Let me ask you this. Have you started to contend? And maybe this is just me, but if you started to contend with how quickly time is going by, and if you started doing that math of like, fuck, man, like based on how quickly I'm experiencing the flow of time, like I'm going to be 70 before I can blink twice. You know, have you started working with that, or does time flow by at a normal speed?
Well, I feel like it's this weird thing. Like when I look back on my life, it seems so long, and all the lives I've lived are just so, I can't believe I've gotten to experience so many different things in one lifetime. And I have so much more of a lifetime to go. And at the same time, it seems as if it's been going by, it's coming at me quickly, but it's passing behind me so slowly, if that makes sense. And then I think in comparison to like, I've been alive for 36 years, and it has felt like a slog, and just with so many different things that have happened. And then I compare that to someone who's been in prison for that period of time, where they have almost the same experience day in and day out.
Yeah.
How long that must feel to them.
Yeah.
Like time is just so relative, depending on your situation. And whenever I think of someone that's been in prison for like 25 years, I'm just like, that. I cannot imagine their concept of time as compared to ours.
Oh, it's a brutality. I mean, it's so weird that, like, there's a, you know, no cruel and unusual punishment, but you're allowed to take a sentient creature, put it in a, lock them up for a life, and just say you'll never come out. And somehow that's not cruel and unusual. Have you heard, there's, you know, as people like theorize about the future of psychoactive chemicals, and the more we understand the human brain, the more we can manipulate it. Have you heard the theory that they're going to be able to inject you with a prison sentence where instead of having to put you in prison for 50 years, they can inject you with a drug that gives you the experience of 50 years, but only takes like an hour? Have you heard that? Yeah, pharmaceutical like prison sentences saves a lot of money. Not such a, but at the end of your like, or like, you know, there's other ways they
is there a way to inject them with rehabilitative care, you know, to like to fix the synapses in their brain that makes them want to commit crime?
Well, isn't the idea though, like part of the punishment is like, you know, whenever you're watching the court shows and shit, it's like, and the asshole finally gets the prison sentence, it's the families are like, finally, justice has been served. Like, it's a, it's something that's supposed to bring balance to the families, or right or wrong or something like that. So no one really wants rehabilitation. Well, you know, if someone kills your fucking mom, you're like, oh, great. Did you get rehabilitated?
Right.
Fuck you.
I mean, would justice not be, you know, reversing who this person is and making them contribute a good to society? Wouldn't that be the true justice if they were rehabilitated to then do good within the world?
I think it depends on the culture. It's like some people want them to hurt. I mean, you know, this is like one of the weirdest theories of what we are or where we're at. It's like, you know, this is prison. We committed some crime in whatever we were before we were born. We did some insanely horrific fucking thing. And as punishment, we've been sentenced to a human incarnation where there is the quality of rehabilitation that's happening. I mean, you look at yourself in the barn getting fucking hammered, or you on the street, the old Ian versus you now, you can see there's a trend that's happening where you're, you know, evolving into a better and better person. Not just that part of you, but career-wise and everything. You're becoming sweeter. Your other people are like inspired by you. Any addict listening to this who's still in the fucking barn, you know, they take, they're probably going to be a little inspired. The point is, yeah, the idea is like, yeah, no, you did get injected. We were in some futuristic society. You probably, who knows what the fuck you did, man? You like, who knows? Maybe you like threw someone off a building, or I don't know, like jerked off onto a sleeping space emperor. I don't know. I don't even know if that's a crime. I don't even know if that's a crime in the future, but the point
is, it better not be, because if that's the case, they're going to lock me up.
I just love jerking off on sleeping emperors, Your Honor. Come on. Don't make me.
Sorry, Your Honor. I never got into sports. I mean, I am fortunate in that I have actively taken the reins of giving myself rehabilitative care. And I just like in terms of prisoners, like nobody wants, there's this push to release non-violent drug offenders, non-violent crimes, and just release them, which is like, okay, but at the same time, these people have had to adjust and adapt themselves to a universe we couldn't even fathom as a means of survival.
Right.
So yeah, you may have gone to jail at 19 for a nonviolent drug crime, but after 15 years, you're coming out with a cosmic psychic change in your brain of how you deal with the world around you. And to just release you into society without rehabilitative care, without some sort of step down into the world in which is not the same that you've been living in, is only going to create chaos in the world that we exist in, with rules and laws and certain acceptable behaviors. So it's like, yes, release these people, but at the same time, give them the care that they need so that they don't just act like the animals that they've had to adapt into being for survival in this prison world, right. You know? And yeah. People, I don't understand how that's not a full conversation that's at the forefront of this releasing prisoners into society. You can't just release people and say, well, they'll be fine. It's like, that's a very traumatic change in their life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, you're running into the lobbyists. You're running into the for-profit prison lobbyists who, number one, are like, are you fucking kidding? We can't release right. them. That's like, you know what I mean? Every prisoner that we have, we're going to make so much right. money every year. You know, you're making a great profit off of every especially the nonviolent offenders. Cause you know, you get like a sociopath in there, some kind of violent, brutal person, then you're going to have to pay for the medical care for everybody right. they fuck up and all, whatever. You get a nice nonviolent weed dealer. Oh my God, that's a payday. Mm-hmm. Plop them down in the cell and just juice them for as long as you can. Those lobbyists, man, they don't want to release them. And then the other part of it is like the expense it would cost to rehabilitate right. them. I mean, this whole prison as a rehabilitation thing is insane in America.
Like, it's a total lie. And what's happening now with the bail reform in New York City and other cities is it's just a revolving door. I mean, you get arrested, you get a death ticket, you're out that night, and they're finding that the more catch and release they're doing each time, the more and more violent the crime is that they're committing. You know, I mean, this wow. guy was in the subways punching women, and they couldn't lock him up because it was a misdemeanor assault rather than because he didn't steal from them. They couldn't arrest him on a felony. So because it was misdemeanors, they kept letting him out. And he just kept punching random women. And, you know, I don't understand how that is supposed to help society, you know, and would it not give more jobs for people to work in, you know, rehabilitation centers and to yeah. give continuing care to these people that are hurting and sick mentally and emotionally that need help stepping back into society, you know? And also at yeah. the same time, you know, like, I don't know if I believe in the concept of a physical heaven or hell. I think for me, I believe in the concept of heaven and hell is how we spend our time on earth. And if you yes. are locked in a cage for, you know, 35 years, that is hell. You're in hell. You can make it heavenly in a way, but you have to have a strong constitution, you know. And
oh, yeah.
I've been what? In hell. Yeah. I've lived in hell. And now I am finding mm-hmm. my own heaven that exists wherever I go, you know. And I just feel for these people so much.
Hell is density, right? Like, it's like the, you know, I do believe in hell and I do believe in heaven. And where I get that from is not some like faith-based thing, but it's like rooted in this concept of as above, so below, or like, so when you're like, the idea is like, you know, you see the way an apple falls from the tree, and from that you can understand the way planets mm-hmm. move through the solar system. Similarly, you look at these like qualities of like existence that happen to people, and you imagine like, I guess it's like what predicates the line of thought is like, you have to imagine that we're not annihilated when we die. But if we're not annihilated when we die, we're living in an infinite universe, then it's like, what would be worse than prison? What's the next step down from prison? And so in like Buddhism, what you get is like really weirdly similar to the Christian hell, which you're essentially being like boiled in cauldrons for like hundreds of human wow. lifespans, but you're not, it's not permanent. Like there, you can all, nothing's permanent. So you can eventually like get out of that situation. Yeah. Yeah. But if you look at it purely as just like a metaphor or whatever, it, to me, it just represents increasing levels of density. It's like, you know, you start off and you're scared as shit. Or whatever the thing's going on with you, that you're so scared that you numb down. So once you're numb down, you feel like it's okay to go around punching women or robbing people or doing whatever the fuck it is. And so then that state gets mirrored by you in a dense ass fucking prison cell surrounded by other numbed down people who are all feeding off of each other, creating this kind of fucked up resonance, which is then densifying things even more. So just what you're saying, you get the fuck out and it's not like you're rehabilitated. You just become better at being dense. And then that's why there's this incredible recidivism rate, you know, which is like, of course they're going to go back because that's what they've learned.
And the recidivism rate is a direct result of you, the cards stacked up against you where you can't work. You can't exist without, you know, almost like leading yourself back into a life of crime so that you can exist.
Right. Yeah. It's harder to get a job. You can't fucking vote. You're like, you know, good luck getting a fucking job, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, people are hiring. It's like, oh, really? You were what? You're in prison for fucking, you're the dude who is punching women on the fucking subway? Fuck you. No, I've gotten better. I don't do, fuck you. I don't care if you have gotten better.
It's so hard to get a job with a college degree right now, let alone leaving prison with like your go-to behavioral trait is punching women. Like, good fucking luck.
Yeah. That's not, you don't put that on your resume. But like, you know, I'm great at punching women at midnight on the subway. Yeah. If you need that. But to me, when you look at that quality of our society, with all the advanced shit we've got, and we're still doing medieval, we just throw you in a room with bars in front of it for a certain amount of time. That's just what we do. We do the same shit King George was fucking doing with maybe better accommodations. Yeah. You know, you're not having to like compete with rats when you're eating or whatever.
Or
but
even
essentially
for long-term throwing people in a cage, but also, you know, if you get arrested and you're locked up for 24 hours, you're not making your job the next day. You're not calling out. You're just fucking no-showing. And then you lose your job. Yeah. You don't got money. So it's like, let me commit a crime real quick to fucking, you know, pay my rent, get back on my feet. And then boom, you're back in jail.
It's a feedback loop. I mean, so what do you do? I mean, I've seen documentaries on some of like the, like, I think Norwegian prisons, you know what I mean? And they look more like dorm rooms. It is based on rehabilitation.
Right. I mean, if you treat people like humans, they're more prone to act in a human way. Like when I was teaching and I treated my kids like adults, they acted in a mature adult way. When you treat people as if they are the bane of society, well, what do you expect? They're gonna act like fucking jerk-offs.
Dude, this is we have this right now. We're working with like a pretty awesome nanny, and she's like she's of the school of working with kids where you don't baby talk. It doesn't matter if they're eight months old. You talk to them like a person. Because, you know, a lot of times when you're seeing like these kids who are, toddlers, but they're still like kind of babbling. Sometimes that's happening because their parents have just been baby talking them, and that's what they've been hearing. So it's like it's a feedback loop of baby talk. By the way, I don't know how you don't fucking baby talk these things. They're so goddamn cute.
They're,
all you want to do is
balance,
be like,
you? You know.
Yeah, there's a balance. Yeah, but it's like the same situation. If we're prison talking our inmates via like all the other inmates who are like, you know, terrifying them or shaking them down or forcing them to like choose gangs or whatever the fuck happens based on my viewing of Locked Up Raw, you know. I don't know anything about prison. Who the fuck am
I
fooling?
I know, right? We're just talking out our ass. Dude, one time I used to love Locked Up Raw. One time I had a chick over and I put it on and we're like making out. And while we're making out, I hear like, any keister stashed a 9-inch blade. And I'm like, you know, trying to undo her pants. I'm like, maybe I should turn this off.
Yeah, you should. I mean, my wife and I fucked a Sean Hannity, man. It's like, I don't know. It's fucked up. you know, like, what are you going to do? Stop and, like, turn the TV off? No, if you're in the passion of the moment, you just deal with it. But look, what would you do? I mean, if you, let's say you and I get to design our own fucking prison, the goal, rehabilitation. What do we do when we get someone in there who just, like, was robbing a convenience store and just blew someone's face off to get $100? What would you do? What would you do?
I mean, first of all, like you just said, the Norwegian system of, like, dorms. When you set someone up in, like, an esteemable environment, they start to act in esteemable ways, you know? So set them up in a, you know, not like, you know, giving them a recliner and a fucking flat screen, but just, like, you know, not putting them on a steel bench, you know, and making them cook food over a toilet. You know what I mean? Like, giving them an environment that makes them feel human in a way. I mean, look, there's a difference between, like, you can't excuse blowing someone's head off for $100 and being like, let's rehabilitate. You know, that's going to take a lot. But I think having, like, a strong...
What about $1 million?
Well, then who wouldn't do that, you know? But, but, like, you know, having a therapeutic environment, having good psychological care, having, you know, and you also at the same time have to incentivize people going to that field. These people should be getting paid a lot more money, you know, like doctors and psychiatrists and therapists and social workers should be getting paid a lot more to work in these environments to try to help rehabilitate these people through therapeutic care, through workshops, through exercising, through different means of life. And also, not only should this be happening in prison, this should be happening outside of prison, you know?
Okay. All right. Listen, your prison, I don't like it. My prison,
all right,
here's
let's
what
hear
we
it
do.
Fucking commish.
Okay. You're okay. Look, I'm not putting my fucking, you have your little, like, whatever it is, dorm rooms, and you can have your fucking Saturday movie nights with your team of murderers. Here's what I do. My murderer, what I do is I use my neuro downlink to scan the brain residue of the person they shot, reassemble all of their memories, and then I place my karma helmet on this person, and I force them to live the person they murdered's life over and over and over again, experiencing the person's terror and fear when they're dying for, like, 100 straight incarnations. And then I take the helmet off, and I don't know. Then I send them to your prison. You know what I mean? But make them experience, like, you know, that's the, if we just don't have the fucking technology, if we had the technology where you could induce in a person the experience, not just the experience of getting murdered by themselves, but all of the love and joy the person
and
felt.
And at the same time, experience the loss that their family and loved ones feel.
Yes, exactly. They have to experience it. And then, like, they have to experience it many, many, many times.
Like an empathy neuralizer.
Yeah, man, an empathy fucking neuralizer. I sentence you to 100 lifetimes of the person you murdered. You're going to do everything they did, think everything they thought, and it's always going to end with you fucking murdering yourself. But you won't know it's you because you're going to be in another person. Court adjourned. My name is Professor Bong.
Now come lay down in Ian's lazy boy prison recliner. There's massage buttons and your feet get a pedicure.
Yeah, your fucking Sharper Image prison over there with your fucking prisoners getting, like, goddamn heating blankets and fucking nice sips of chrysanthemum tea. I'm sorry you murdered.
Yeah.
Can I rub lotion?
Did you get beat as a little boy and because of your trauma you reenacted that as an adult? Have some prosciutto wrapped melons.
But you look, man, I'm telling you, I love playing around with, like, when I am experiencing suffering, especially suffering that is based on my past decisions, which is most suffering, I like to imagine that I'm, like, that in that suffering, there's some redemptive quality right. happening. There's like a purification happening. You know what I mean? Instead of like going victim, whenever I look at it, I'm like, I actively decided, I made the choice. I did the activity that brought me to this place. And so any kind of horror or suffering I'm experiencing is really just the universe functioning perfectly. Mm. It is a kind of prison sentence, right. You know, it is a kind of, there is true justice. Well, like
and then I just accepting the actions, the consequences of your actions.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. I mean, there's something so liberating about that. The moment you do that, instead of like, you know, imagining that like someone else is to blame.
Right. Well, it goes back to that thing we said about the balance between letting go and acceptance, and also having the mental fortitude to look in the mirror and realize your role in the experience that occurred, rather than just pushing blame, like going, oh, that's me. Oh, I did that. Oh, I can now make a change based off what I did that was negative, you know, instead of just going, oh, it was them. This always happens to me. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, man. Cause like, if we are in some kind of celestial, cosmic, hyperdimensional, futuristic prison, and I know why we're here, you know why we're here, jerked off on the space emperor's face.
And I'll do it again. And
keep doing that. You got to don't say that.
Sorry.
Ian.
Sorry.
You're going to
give me the empathy helmet.
I'm just, but you know, if you do play around with that idea that is what human incarnation is, a prison for the soul, then, but if we were running a prison, then, and prisoners did start taking responsibility for their actions, prisoners did start exhibiting traits of people who were no longer blaming the world for their behavior, but taking responsibility, becoming autonomous, then you would feel like your prison was working, and they would be one step closer to maybe being let out.
Right.
You know? So I'm just saying, if that's what this is, then working with no longer blaming other things for your shit and working with gratitude, if there is some cosmic celestial jailkeeper out there watching everything you do, then that's probably what they're looking for, I would guess.
I mean, is the celestial jailkeeper watching what you do just our consciousness?
Well, yeah, I mean, I say use whatever model works. I mean, like if the, you know, at the end of the fucking day, and the older you goddamn get, the more like when the math simplifies to the point where it's like, well, it seems like the more you can help people, like it seems like basically just try not to hurt. It's like what the Dalai Lama said. If you can help. Mm. If you can't help, don't hurt. You know what I mean? It starts so.
I love that.
You know, whatever model gets you to that point, whether you want to do like, it's just my consciousness and that's all I need, or whether you want to invent some kind of like weirdo hyperdimensional prison fucking guard or whatever, I just say use your own model. Right. Whatever works to like inspire you to become like a better part of whatever your community may be. You know, I don't know. It could be your consciousness. You could imagine it's a little slug that lives at the end of a rainbow. I don't you know what I mean. Like you pick the fucking symbol, but what matters is not so much the symbol as much as like, oh yeah, this pushes me out of my patterns that inevitably result in me hurting myself or other people.
Right. You know? And recognizing those patterns and trying to, you know, when you put your head down on the pillow at night, trying to have done everything you could today to make the mistakes of yesterday make you have a better tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's it. You know, there's a Buddhist teacher who says something like that. Something along the lines of like, oh, are you feeling guilty of some shit you did to someone or whatever, whatever, something in the past, then that guilt is pretty useless. It's definitely not helping them if they're still alive. They don't know that you're guilty, and it's definitely not fucking helping you. But if you really want to, if you really want to make something of the bad shit you did, then going forward, do the opposite of that. Like, bring them into your, you know, bring them into your consciousness in your life, not through like some residual guilt, but through like no longer letting your anger get control.
Like, self-righteous anger gets you nowhere. You know, like, that's why the internet's so toxic, because it's just this fucking loop of anger and outrage that, you know, influence us and our behavior. And when you unplug from that, you realize things aren't as bad as they seem. Like, the world is a pretty cool fucking place.
Yeah. No, yeah, man. Like, God, I think there is a, I mean, I'm fantasizing. There's a collective realization of like, wait, I don't have to look at Twitter anymore. Like, I don't have to like look at that. I don't have to engage with that at all. I don't need to get into it with people out there who are, you know, who the fuck knows who they are anyway. Like 20% of them are bots.
Totally.
You know, 40% of them are like 12-year-olds, you know, 30% of them are like completely bonkers.
And 99% of them would be more forgiving to, you know, a violent offender than someone that said the wrong thing that they want to keep bringing up to bring them down over and over.
Yeah. Yeah. And the energy behind it is weirdly similar to like the same energy of the people doing fucked up shit.
There should be,
you know what I mean?
Like we make prisoners do community service, but if you're actively outraged online all the time, you should then have to do community. You should only allowed to be outraged if you have actively tried to physically help your community in some way.
You get an outrage token.
Yeah, yeah.
You can do one. You just did 15 hours of service in your community, going around giving masks to people who need them, educating people about vaccines, whatever the fucking thing is. You just did 15 hours of service. Now you're allowed. You know what? You know who's allowed to fucking do it? Who's allowed to put people on blast? Goddamn doctors. Yeah. You know what I mean? Those, if you want to fucking, if you're a doctor out there, you can put people on blast. My family's friends with a doctor, and it's just like, it's fucked. They're just like, well, you know, like we have, and I actually, when I got COVID recently, I'd been getting fed up with a goddamn perturbed nurse meme. You know what I mean? The stories from nurses being like, you don't understand. And I'm like, this can't be real. And then the nurse who was coming in to give me my fucking IV drips of zinc and NAD and all this great shit that I think really helped me get over COVID. She worked in a maternity ward, a COVID maternity ward. That's fun for pregnant women who are coming in with COVID. And, you know, these people, as she's talking to me, I'm looking at her, listening to her, recognizing like, you are, I didn't say it, why would you? But no one needs to say it. You are severely traumatized. Yes. You are going to be traumatized probably for the rest of your life.
You're a war veteran.
But like, it's a war veteran. But what she's saying casually is she's like stringing up my freaking Illuminati fucking IV drip and vitamins and shit. And she's like, yeah, we keep a kit in front of the rooms of the pregnant mothers who have COVID because we have to go in there when they die and cut their stomach open to get the baby out. You know, like, what? You know, to me, I think those people, they are justified in putting people on blast.
They get their outrage token.
Yeah, they get an outrage token. But unless you're doing that, unless you're like in the COVID wards cutting babies out of, but even then, maybe that's not the point, though. Because it goes back to the rehabilitation idea. It's like, how much is the fucking outrage creating the change you want to see in the world, right? Like, is it effective? That's the big question. Like, does it work? I know it doesn't work for me. When I'm getting put on blast by somebody, I just dig my heels in.
Hate and anger is never effective. That's why, like, this whole narrative for the past four fucking years of, like, turn your back on your family, tell your friends that they're racist, do this and that. It's like, you get more flies with honey. Like, why are we throwing vinegar on everything when we should be having loving conversations where we're understanding the other side? Because then you can inject some form of knowledge or understanding to make someone tweak their view of how they weren't seeing it before.
Dude, this is what I love about my recovered addict friends, is they are the least judgmental when they recognize that you're like drinking too much, or when you tell them like, man, I'm fucking hooked on this thing. You don't get the judgment. You don't get the thing, because they've all been there and they understand the dynamic of it. And there's this like real deep compassion and empathy and love that isn't, because like most recovered addicts, every recovered addict I've met, they understand, well, I can't save you. Like, there's nothing I can do. You're going to keep doing your thing until you, what do they say? Until you die or go to jail.
Jail's institutions and death. And it is, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it stop doing heroin.
But it's a great poet. My God, that fucking horse. It's like, you should read that horse's poetry. Beautiful, beautiful heroin horse
poetry. I mean, that's why they call it being on the horse.
Yeah, man. I think there's something to be said for this, like being pragmatic when it comes to, you know, your goals. Like, it's like, I think a lot of folks out there are really afraid, and I get, you know, fear turns into anger, and that's the toxic shit that we're seeing online, is just terrified, very scared people who are like really going through it. And so that, you know, the fear translates into like the shit that we're railing against right now. But like, I think like, you know, there's something Jack Kornfield, this Buddhist teacher, says that I really love, which is if you're going to save the planet, save it because you love it. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to save something, do it because you love it. If you want to save a person, if you want like to love them first and then save them.
Lead with love.
You know, but don't hate them. Yeah. Yeah, or try to lead with love, because like, how do
try to? And that love starts with gratitude, really.
Yeah.
How can you love without gratitude, you know? And I know for me, like in my experience, anytime anyone was like, stop drinking, look what you're doing, you got to stop, it made me want to show up at their doorstep with a bottle of vodka and be like, oh, you want me to stop? How's this? I'll stop when I'm done this fucking bottle, you know? And it's, you know, a saying in the recovery community is attraction, not promotion, you know? Like,
what does that mean?
Attraction, not promotion. Like, make your life attractive rather than promoting what you've done. Like, you know, when AA was founded by Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob was a hopeless drunk, and everyone was telling him, you know, you need to stop, you need to do this, you need to do that. And when Bill Wilson visited him in the hospital room, he said, I'm not here for you, I'm here for me. And he shared his experience, and was the first person that he didn't tell him what to do. He told him what he did and what worked for him and how he was. Yeah. And he made that attractive to Dr. Bob. And then they, you know, formed a way of recovery that was different than what was existing at the time.
That's brilliant, man. Attraction instead of promotion. Yeah, that's the, you know, a lot of people who get into spirituality, they become these like, it's very sweet and I get it. They become these promoters of the thing. So like, they're always giving ear beatings. I was one of them where blah, blah, blah. Just anyone, unsolicited fucking ear beatings left and right. When you meet people who've really been like working on themselves for a long time, that is gone. In fact, they barely ever talk about, like, there isn't much of a conversation about it. They're not promoting it, but you look at them and you're like, how are you like this? How are you so full of love? And how is it that whenever I'm around you, like I feel like inspired and reminded of my own potential, and like, you know what? What is that? And then you ask them, and then maybe they'll talk to you a little bit about it. But they're
no one's ever been convinced by hearing "you should." You know, you're more likely to convince someone by saying "I did." You know.
Yeah, man. I mean, and maybe there's like, you know. Yeah, yeah. Maybe there's something like, someone in my family is like struggling with a late term, like someone who's like deep into heroin, and it's like, there's no, like, I don't see how there's any hope at all, and for her, and like you, like all the, it's like it wrecks a fucking family,
and the
like,
sad of it is, you know, when you're going through it, you think you're the only one that you're hurting, you can't see that the ripple effects of it.
Yeah, man, you don't realize you're like rippling out to people you don't even fucking know. Kids you don't even fucking know. But that's still not going to make you change. That's the problem. I, you know, even that, it's like, but I don't know, maybe something about when you're around addicts is like, some of them, it's not like they pity you, or it's not like, but they do look at you like, I don't know if you'll stay alive. A lot of us don't. Like a lot of addicts, they don't stay, they don't. You know that, man. A lot of people just don't make it out of it. But it's like, you know, going to someone who's that imploded or cratered and then grabbing them and shaking them sure as fuck isn't going to do anything. I guess that's the bottom
line.
You
got to lead with love, you know. And a lot of people are addicts and alcoholics because they feel no love, you know, and they feel no love within themselves.
Yeah.
And so they keep repeating the behavior because it's the escape from the fact that they have no love.
But how do you exhibit love towards someone who has like stolen from you, hurt you, fucked up your family multiple times, lied to you? How do you show love to that?
At a certain point, you can love as best you can, and then you need to learn to love from a distance. And sometimes it gets to the point where the most loving thing you can do is to shut them out. You know, like the most loving thing you can do is, you know, like with my ex, the most loving thing I can do, because she refuses help and will never recognize that she has this issue, the most loving thing I can do is to never contact her again. You know, and learning to love from a distance. And you know what? Sometimes people don't get it, but love is a fluid. The definition of love is fluid. It takes on many different forms. And, you know, you can love someone through a hug. You can love someone through action, or you can love someone from a distance. And sometimes when people just don't get it, you backing off is a form of love, because it shows them just how, you know, dark and bleak things can get without having a support system.
Yeah. Fuck. Well, Ian, I'm going to go jerk off on a space emperor's face. I am so grateful to
you, man.
I love these conversations. I'm so happy for you. We didn't get to talk about your stand-up, but God damn, you are kicking ass right now, man. And it's like, when we were going out on the road together, man, you were fucking brutally tough to follow. You're so goddamn funny. And it's so cool to watch you doing this, man. And like, anyway, I just want to say I'm really happy you're in my life, Ian, and I'm really glad.
I'm so grateful to you, Duncan. You're like a brother to me, and I love you so much. And I just, you know, have so much gratitude for you and your existence. Even when we're not speaking, you affect my life in just watching you from afar. And when we get to connect like this, it's fucking awesome, man.
The best. You got to come up to Asheville, man. Come up here, spend some time up in the mountains. You got to meet my kids.
I would love that. I absolutely, dude.
Great. Yeah, let's do it, man. Maybe we could put together some shows or something.
You know, man.
Cool.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, love I love you, Duncan. Ian. Thank you so much. That was Ian Fidance, everybody. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors, Upstart, StatHero, and BetterHelp. And God bless you for listening. I love you all so much, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.